Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, and I'm here with
Keith Phipps
and Genevieve Kosky.
Scott Tobias recently met a rich, attractive woman who wants to pay him a huge salary to train young film critics to write reviews in some far-flung exotic country. So he's away this week and possibly forever, depending on how that works out for him. I mean, I don't see how it could possibly go wrong. In the meantime, to fill his empty seat, we have brought in a guest, Chicago critic Deirdre Crimmins. Welcome aboard, Deirdre.
Oh, hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. I like talking about movies.
Nice to have you here, and maybe nice to be watching a couple of like relatively warm, sunny films in the middle of yet another dreary February in Chicago.
It's actively snowing right now, so we'll take it.
Yeah, it's probably a good time to be indoors talking about films.
We want to visit warmer, more temperate places like London.
Yes, highly exotic places like London, you know, where they speak another language and have another culture and whatnot. Oh, well, it is what it is. So last week we kind of broke formula. We discussed a currently airing TV show / video game adaptation, The Last of Us, alongside Children of Men. This week we're steering straight back into cinema. And as I kind of alluded to, this is a couple of really cinematic movies, both of which kind of tap into some old school movie traditions. Genevieve, how about setting the stage for us here?
Sure. In the next two episodes, we're looking at a couple of features that take very different approaches to similar stories about dance. Magic Mike's Last Dance, the third movie in Channing Tatum's Male Stripper with a Heart of Gold series, marks Steven Soderbergh's return to the franchise after leaving the steamiest entry, 2015's Magic Mike XXL, in other hands. This time around, Tampa carpenter / bartender / stripper / choreographer Mike Lane meets a rich socialite, Maxandra Mendoza, played by Salma Hayek, who's so taken with his charms that she invites him to come to London at her expense and help her plan a show at a theater she owns, with the promise of a huge payday that might get his beloved carpentry shop back on its feet. All of which reminded us of Vincente Minnelli's 1951 classic, An American in Paris, also about a struggling artist, this time played by Gene Kelly, who meets a rich socialite who wants to bankroll his work. As a side connection, Kelly obviously is also a dancer, though a very different kind of dancer than Magic Mike.
Yeah, there are a lot of differences here, starting off with the huge gap between the politics of a man being supported by a woman in 1951 versus a man working for a woman in 2023. And maybe finishing off with how rarely Gene Kelly strips down to his underwear in American Paris to do a slow, erotic lap dance with his co-star. We'll get into the difference between shaking your moneymaker for a bored, lonely, wealthy lady 70-plus years ago and shaking it today after this break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is Paris, and I'm an American who lives here. I'm a painter. All my life, that's all I've ever wanted to do. Brother, if you can't paint in Paris, you better give up and marry the boss's daughter. Oh, I have a lot of good friends in Paris. A lot of very good friends.
And I am one of them. I'm a concert pianist. That's a pretentious way of saying I'm unemployed at the moment. I like Paris. It's a place where you don't run into old friends, although that has never been one of my problems. Strangely enough, I made a friend over here once. I worked for him. His name was Henri Borel. You know, the French music hall star. Do you remember him?
I remember, because that is me.
Begin today, you'll find it now.
Broadly speaking, you can divide movie musicals into two categories. The ones written as a piece, with a story in mind, and song and dance sequences meant to serve that story, and what are called trunk musicals, or jukebox musicals, with stories written primarily to showcase existing music. It's often pretty easy to tell them apart. Even if you don't know every song by the Beatles or ABBA, it's pretty clear that the songs in Mamma Mia or Yellow Submarine are more like fantasy intervals in a frame story than, say, the songs in Fiddler on the Roof or Umbrellas of Cherbourg or Encanto, which actually tell the story and move characters forward in important ways. And just as broadly speaking, trunk musicals are more likely to struggle to make the songs relevant to the characters in the story, since the songs weren't written originally with the idea that they'd be coming from a consistent set of voices or personalities. If the songs are good, the personalities are strong, and someone worked to make the musical interludes relevant to the story, you get something like Singing in the Rain, where those interludes might feel like hiccups in the narrative, but not like road bumps to its progress. Otherwise, you might end up with An American in Paris, a movie that's charming, well-meant, and engaging, but full of musical road bumps that stop the story cold. After Rhapsody in Blue composer George Gershwin died in 1937, MGM executive Arthur Freed bought up the rights to his musical catalog, with the idea of building a musical specifically around Gershwin's orchestral composition, An American in Paris. Freed insisted that the number couldn't stand alone. It had to be surrounded by other Gershwin songs. So he commissioned playwright Alan J. Lerner, the writer of Brigadoon and later My Fair Lady, to write a quick script around a number of Gershwin tunes, including I Got Rhythm, Stairway to Paradise, and Swonderful. Freed was specifically looking for a spectacle with An American in Paris. Like so many movie studios, MGM in the late 1940s and early 1950s was out to lure in a war-weary audience by selling them on fantasy, color, spectacle, and escapism. The tactic certainly worked in this case. The movie opened to rave reviews that largely praised that spectacle while noting the thinness of the story. It was a box office success that won Best Picture at the Academy Awards that year, along with five other Oscars. It's the kind of movie that sent audiences away on a high note after a 17-minute virtuoso dance fantasy sequence that ends with the charming lead, Jerry Mulligan, getting everything he wants. Immediately after that fantasy sequence, Jerry's dreams come true in his real life as well. And then the movie abruptly cuts to a The End card without ever bothering to wrap up the rest of its loose ends. And that's a pretty oddball way to close when you consider the rest of the movie. Gene Kelly stars as Jerry, the American in Paris of the title. He's a former GI who stayed in France after his service in the war to study painting in the Europe of the old masters. Lerner's script hands Jerry a couple of local buddies. Adam, a would-be concert pianist played by Oscar Levant, and French dance hall singer Henri, played by George Guattari. These two are mostly in the movie to enable different kind of Gershwin tunes, including another lengthy fantasy sequence where Adam fantasizes about playing Gershwin's Concerto in F for piano and orchestra, serving as the pianist, the conductor, all of the other musicians, and the appreciative audience. But Lerner doesn't care much about these two friends and how their stories end up. The bigger focus is on Jerry's love life as he meets lonely rich heiress Milo, played by Nina Falk, while he's peddling his paintings on the street. Milo likes Jerry's work and wants to set him up with a nice studio and an exhibition of his own. But she also wants to romance him, which he resists, especially after he spots perky young Lisa Bouvier, played by Leslie Caron, in a cafe, and starts mercilessly bullying her and manipulating her for a date. The way Jerry can't hear Lisa's repeated refusals and requests to be left alone is just one way An American Paris rankles a bit for modern audiences. The fact that he gets his way by lying to her friends to get her away from them, then showing up at her workplace to hector her and steamroll her over her protests is another. And then, of course, she falls in love with Jerry, even though she's already dating his friend Henri, who she feels indebted to for saving her life during the war. She feels she can't tell either of them the truth. In the same way, Jerry doesn't exactly tell Milo he isn't interested in her romantically, but it feels like it wouldn't matter if he did, because she steamrollers all over his protests with the same blithe refusal to hear anything that doesn't fit her fantasies. This is not a movie where people often listen to each other, or take each other seriously, no matter what serious protests are raised. It also isn't a movie where the screenwriter cares that much about the characters, apart from the question of whether Jerry and Lisa get a made-for-the-screen happily ever after. After the big fantasy ballet, Lerner drops Milo and Adam cold. We never find out whether they get any of what they want, although a modern writer probably would have put the two together, since they seem exactly suited to each other's needs. We never get to hear Henri's side of the story or find out how Jerry's fraught, much-discussed exhibition goes. And that's because American in Paris is resisting any hint of melancholy or compromise at the end. It's meant to be a feel-good story, so it has to cut the second someone might not be fully satisfied with the ending. And yet there's so much melancholy baked into both the premise and the making of the film. Lisa losing her family and becoming dependent on a man she believes she owes her body and soul to, that's pretty tragic. Henri believing she loves him when she just feels guilty about him is another tragedy. Jerry and Adam are artists who don't believe in their art or their skills and are afraid to put them out in the world. And then there's Milo, trying over and over to buy love from artists who disappear once they get what they want or just get tired of her. This is actually a pretty sad movie in its way, or at least a movie with a mournful, melancholy streak like so much of the Gershwin music that animates it. But who'd notice, with Gene Kelly tap dancing and smiling, and Leslie Caron grinning her way through that introductory scene where Jerry listens to Henri's description of her and imagines her as essentially five different women. But that's wartime cinema for you. There's so many dark, sad assumptions in the background of this story, and so much effort put into keeping everyone smiling. That's also jukebox musicals for you. The story, in essence, barely matters. What matters is comfortingly familiar music and comfortingly familiar faces, and the attempt to combine them into something startling and new that we've never seen on the screen. In that sense, at least, An American in Paris is still a winner, and still capable of giving viewers the same energy they were getting out of it more than 70 years ago.
I can understand disregarding perspective to achieve an effect, but in your case,
look,
I
honey,
believe that...
Why don't you be a good little girl and move on? You're not going to buy anything, and you're just blocking out the sunshine.
Well, I just wanted to discuss your work.
I don't want you to discuss my work. I'm not interested in your opinion of my work. If you say something nice, it won't make me feel any better, and if you don't, it'll bother me. Thank you. Good day.
Do you mind if I look, or will you chew my head off, too?
No, go ahead. You're okay.
Oh, thank you.
She's one of those third-year girls that gripe my liver.
Third-year girl?
Yeah, you know, American college kids. They come over here to take their third year and lap up a little culture. They give me a swift pain.
Why, they're harmless enough.
They're officious and dull. They're always making profound observations they've overheard.
Okay, everybody, let's jump into An American in Paris. I'm curious what you make of this movie in 2023. As always, we don't like the word dated exactly, but there's certainly some aspects of the kind of the relationship politics and the manners of romance here that don't land. But honestly, I feel like maybe the biggest thing here is... this is a musical expressly built around music that would have been just like household familiar tunes in some cases to people in 1951, and that some of them feel a lot more obscure today. How does this movie overall play for you right now? Deirdre, let's start with you.
The thing on a rewatch that really struck me, and I've seen this film so many times, is how often Gene Kelly's friends make fun of him for being supported by a woman and make like blatant references to him possibly putting out in order to like earn his keep. That is something that like I was like, oh, okay, that's just an assumption because there's no way, why else would a woman be supporting the arts here? Yeah, I think that it lands a little different in that that is really being called attention to in the gender politics there, not that they're not in Magic Mike. Also, I don't know if this is the time to bring it up, but Gene Kelly's art actually isn't that good. So.
I think we're going to get that at some point. This is kind of like an example of why you don't actually show the art, or why you don't actually, you know, read the poetry of fictional characters who write, you know, who create wonderful art or whatever. It's mm-hmm. fine, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I wish we had another signal in the film to indicate like what anyone other than Milo thought of his art, you know, just to kind of like orient ourselves in terms of how good it is supposed to be versus what we're actually seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we get something from his friend Adam towards the very end of the film where Adam basically says like he's not ready and they're going to tear him apart.
Adam's just such a like cynical jerk.
That's true. And we have the understanding that Adam does not himself like put his music out there. Like he's a concert pianist who, if I recall correctly, has never played a concert.
That's what they say.
How's that work?
Seems like an odd detail. So yeah, it is, even his opinion is compromised. But yes, it would be nice, except that the movie is so uninterested in that question. Like we never do actually find out what comes of that art exhibition.
Yeah.
I guess at the top of this episode, I wanted to say that any thought that we give to the themes and plot of this movie, or with all due respect to Alan J. Lerner, a giant of the stage and film, probably more thought than he gave to them in some ways, you know? I mean, it is, you know, I really do like this film quite a bit, but I kind of like, you know, this rewatch, and like, it's kind of felt like maybe a second tier of the great musicals in many ways, because the parts are so wonderful and they're strung together on, you know, a not great plot. And then I think, I'm sure we'll get into is like every element is like, ooh, I don't know if I like that very much at all.
I mean, even aside from the relationship, gender politics, like one of the ones that really threw me was when Ad was like when he's trying to distract Henri and Jerry from like talking, and he's like, "Let me tell you about the time I played a command performance for Hitler." It was like, right? Like, whether that's true or a lie, it's a really weird thing to just toss out there, especially like right on the heels of World War II, as this is.
But see, I don't think it is an odd thing. I think that it's just one of a bunch of assumptions being made in this film about, we all have this shared history. We all have this big traumatic shared event that we just came through. All of this entire movie is made in the shadow of, you know, Lisa's backstory is just so painful, and it's just kind of assumed that, like, you know, probably everybody has gone through something ugly. You know, these men are all fresh off of a war. Henri is fresh off of, you know, watching his country being taken over by the Nazis. And the fact that he had a close encounter with Hitler both doesn't seem surprising and does seem interesting to me. Like, if I had that story, I would pull it out at every opportunity too, especially if I was trying to distract people. And the fact that they don't say either, yes, you've told us 1,000 times, or wait, what?
I guess I'll, since we're talking about dangling threads a little bit, I'll kind of jump back to the question of like what it was like to watch this movie today. And like, I can't believe we haven't really even mentioned it yet, but the one thing I feel people know about this movie is the big dream ballet sequence at the end. Like, I feel like it's sort of its defining feature. At least that's what I always think of first with this film. And what I always forget is that it's not the end, and there is this like happily ever after, rushing back into each other's arm, happy ending that frankly I hate. Like I because it does leave like the, like, okay, what about his art show? What about Milo? You know, I guess Henri's just cool with it. But like, I feel like if it just like ended on the fantasy, if it like had the, I don't want to say had the courage, I don't want to tell movies what to do, and I know that a movie of this era would be highly unlikely to do this, but if it did just end on that dream ballet, it would have just this like melancholy ending that I feel would be so much more resonant than what we have, which just feels kind of like a rubber stamp happy ending that doesn't really take into account the rest of the movie outside of this romance.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to defend this film as a narrative, is it really does seem to be going for trying to be a musical about difficult grown-up relationships in some ways, like how you know, romance is sticky and it's overlaps sometimes, and you know, you feel one way about one person, one way about another, and you know if it had kept going and maybe resolved some of those threads, it might be easier to defend as that. Or I think, as you say, if it were just kind of cut off on the sort of this bittersweet note of that ballet, it would be, you know, be a stronger film in some ways.
Yeah, I think a lot of the film asks, like, rewatching it as many times as I've had, the like overwhelming question that keeps coming through for me is like, what do you owe people? Like, what does Lise owe Henri, having saved her from the war, essentially? Do you owe him a marriage? Like, and does Jerry owe Milo anything beyond just a painting exhibition? Like, there's this whole thing where there's the questions that are put forth are much more complicated than they really seem at first, because on paper it's like, no, you don't owe this person that, but it's like, but don't you? Like, there's this social contract there that they're all playing into, which is why it's always so weird when Henri like re-delivers Lise back, and it's like, you're literally dropping her off at this like,
yeah,
broke guy. Like, did he believe that she did owe him anything, or was it just because she felt like she couldn't say like, thanks, that was fun, like, that she like is going on? Like, it's just so strange to me, like the weight of what is like a currency in their world. And it just seems to kind of fall by the wayside at the end. It's like, yeah, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter.
I mean, I have to assume just because of the way it's framed, like we see Henri overhearing the conversation between the two of them and understanding at least that she's in love with somebody else. And he doesn't choose to just faff off at that moment. He takes her away in his car and there's a long pause and then he brings her back. And I have to assume that they had a thoughtful conversation in the car where he gets the Casablanca ending where he's like, you actually love him and I'm capable of giving you up because I'm an adult. And the fact that the movie doesn't think we need to see any of that, that it's Henri's feelings and his nobility and his still caring about Lisa as somebody he wants to protect and like wants her to have a happy life. All of that is just so much more resonant and much more of a happy ending to me than, and you ended up with this jerk who, you know, is not interested in any no that you have to say about anything. I mean, in terms of the complicated issues of what do we owe each other, mostly what I was thinking throughout this film is all these people owe each other the truth. Like, grow up, tell people what you're thinking, especially people you're planning to get married to. And the fact that Lerner just didn't feel we needed to see the part where everybody talked about like their actual grown-up feelings and what they wanted. And it was just much more important to spend 17 minutes dancing around a fake fountain full of smoke. I just find really disappointing. Although that fountain is a really great special effect. Yeah. This was my first time seeing An American in Paris.
Oh.
And throughout that entire sequence, I was just so distracted every time the fountain showed up, just like looking at how it was constructed. It's a really neat effect.
It's this big plexiglass thing. Yeah. I will say, even with all those so-called social contracts around, like, I have zero concerns about Milo after the fact. Like, she's going to be aces. Yeah. Like, she's got everything going on for her.
A couple months down the road, she'll find another artist to support.
She's locked into a really unhappy pattern, though, right? I mean, you know, we were told that she's done this before, and she'll probably undoubtedly do it again, but I don't know. I think Milo got done dirty, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not even nice to her, you know? And the film's attitude toward her is a little rough, I think. You know, what does she do that's so wrong besides having money and trying to support people and maybe having a crush in the process? Maybe I'm being too kind to her, but...
Well, no, there's that one line she gets that's like, I finally feel like a woman. Like like the film like really puts her in this position of, because she has the power in this relationship, she is not really a woman and does not have like her desires are not womanly. And especially when placed next to Lisa, who this like 19-year-old just naive beauty, you know, like it feels unfair, like you said, like the characterization of Milo as, she's not quite villain, but I think she's probably the closest thing this movie has to a villain, or what it thinks is a villain.
You know what blew me away? Do you know how old Nina Foch was when this film came out?
Oh, I'm just gonna say 27.
27. You're exactly
really?
Right. It's so crazy.
Less because I was interested in how old she was and more because I was interested in her relative age compared to Gene Kelly, because I really felt like this movie was coding her as the older woman who is undesirable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she's 12 years younger than Gene Kelly.
I don't know if she's supposed to be undesirable, but she's definitely supposed to be kind of the older person who ought to have settled down by this point, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no insult to her appearance at all, because she's lovely, but she does look older. I mean, she does look like a mature woman in a way that a 27-year-old on screen usually doesn't, unless she's Lauren Bacall.
Yeah. But to me at least, she's got this Lauren Bacall glamour that Leslie Caron just doesn't have. Like, I find her... To the degree that I mack on women in movies, I just find her so much more attractive than Leslie Caron in this film.
Yeah, and there is this undercurrent there of, like, this is how she can get men, and this is the only... I don't know if it's the only way that she can get men, but it's, like, her being able to sponsor men as a way to kind of, like, seduce them on a certain level because of, like, her crush on Jerry and things like that, whereas, like, she's gorgeous and she's young and she's got money. Like, what more do you want, were she to actually just go out and find a partner on her own?
Yeah, I feel like Milo, while I'm 95% with Keith in terms of Milo gets a raw deal out of this whole thing, I do think that to the degree that she has any villainy here, to the degree she can be blamed for anything, kind of submerging her desire, her just outright desire for Jerry. Because I really do think that she looks at him and thinks, oh, he's cute. I'd like to talk to him. And what she says instead was, oh, I love your art. I have to buy some of it. And then I think she thinks he's really cute and should like to date him. And what she says instead is, I'd like to buy you a studio. I'd like to buy you an exhibition. I'd like to buy you a future. And if she was just falling back on the fact that she's beautiful and charming and sophisticated and rich and well-spoken and interesting and obviously actually a fan of the arts, who likes going out to jazz cafes, all of that really seems like it should be enough to land her a date without all of these pretenses, which do actually get in the way of any kind of relationship she could have. Like, as long as she's chasing this man who just is really obvious about the fact that he doesn't want her, but is willing to hang out with her for what she can buy him, she's going to be stuck with gold digging men. And it just sounds like that's been the pattern. Like, you know, they stay with her because she's paying for everything. And then they leave either when they get successful or they get tired of her, you know, as if it would be easy to get tired of somebody who just seems so charming and thoughtful and interesting and intelligent.
I think the idea, though, is it's emasculating to them. Yeah. And I think that's kind of, when, you know, when she says it makes me feel like a woman, we're supposed to see, like, you know, you kiss me and now I'm kind of in my proper position here.
The fact that, like, he will only agree to go out with her in the first place if it's a cheap place that he can afford to pay. Like, you know, like, right from the jump, like, his like willingness to socialize with her is wrapped up in a condition that like people don't know he is being supported by her.
Right from the jump, she is setting up their relationship to be based on a transaction there. Like, it's not like she's just like, oh, do you want to grab a coffee and like talk about this? She's like, I'm going to pay you the instant they meet. So like right out there, the precedent is just all it's about money.
And like, that's maybe a quote unquote bad move on her part as far as establishing this precedent. But it also feels like very informed by the, you know, social mores of the time, you know, like I wasn't there, but I feel like, you know, it was probably not very common for a woman to just casually ask a man out for coffee. I don't know, maybe Paris, who knows with Paris, but you know, in this version of Paris, that doesn't seem like it would be acceptable.
I feel like we could talk about their relationship and the dynamics and how frustrating they are, you know, for an hour. But I don't want to get bogged down. There is a lot of this movie to talk about. And one of the biggest things, I guess, as I was watching it, is just, as I say, it's a jukebox musical and it just really feels it to me. There's just a lot of, it's time for another musical number. Let's pull one out of the Gershwin and an Ira Gershwin song box. How can we possibly fit this in? I don't know. Gene Kelly's just going to sing and dance. You love Gene Kelly singing and dancing. What more could you want? And
bust out a tap dance, Gene. Somehow, their flat surface, tap dance on it.
First time he just starts tap dancing out of nowhere, I'm like, wait, has he been walking around in his tap shoes this entire time?
You aren't?
It's a musical. It's all fantasy.
If anyone can justify wearing tap shoes around all the time, I would say it's Gene Kelly.
That's true. There are flat surfaces everywhere, and he has danced on most of them, up to and including the walls. Apart from the giant 17-minute-long, ballet at the end, did any of these musical numbers stand out for you? Like, you're all rewatching this movie, which I'm not. Was there anything that you were actively looking forward to?
I like all of them. I like the kids. You know, the kids in the streets is one I really remember distinctly. I like.
Did you shaking your head? No.
No, I like the kids. All right, I like.
You know, sorry, little, Keith. I also this little don't chaplain like the
thing.
Kids.
I don't know. I like the piano scene. I what I like about, I think what part of what makes the movie interesting is that all the other musical sequences are small, which doesn't mean they're not intricate or impressive. But they're the, you know, humble surroundings, a street or an apartment or whatever. And then it just opens up into that fantasy Paris in the ballet at the beginning. I think that's a really neat contrast. But one thing I just like about Kelly so much in general, and in this movie, you can really see it, is especially in those early scenes, it's kind of like, it's so effortless. It's kind of like, Well, I go, you know, I'm just going to casually segue into this amazing tap dance number. And here I am, you know, whirling around like an airplane propeller, like you've never seen before. And then with a smile on my face, and then I'm done. And it's back to what I was doing before. And I think, you know, just the idea of these fairly humble, although obviously, you know, backlot created versions of French locations, you know, turning into these wonderful scenes for amazing dance numbers, the best of them featuring children. Because, you know, everyone loves that scene.
Everyone except?
Okay, everyone else on this podcast, apparently, but still.
I will never think that children singing is the right way to go. Like, never. Yeah, well.
Even if it's only one syllable?
I'm fine. No, it's just, it's not adding anything to my life. No, I think children singing is creepy, and I will always stand by that, especially as a horror fan. I will say, though, it's very clear our love is here to say number down by the river. I kind of have a hot soft spot for, but only for the fact that Billy Crystal references it heavily in the movie Forget Paris, which is quite forgettable, but I adore that film. So yeah, I'm just like, oh, it's coming up, but it's more like a film from the 90s that's referencing all the way back. That doesn't mean it's good. It means I like it.
I mean, I'll bring up a couple of non-Gene Kelly numbers, which I think, Keith, you briefly mentioned the Adams, like, dream symphony, mm-hmm. You know, so, like, zero reason for that sequence to be in this film. But it's, you know, it's a fun little filigree, and I guess a fun moment for that character to ham it up a little without having to sing, because mm-hmm. he's not really a great singer. In the other numbers.
The fact that we know so little about him in some ways, he's just kind of this like irascible yet sort of amiable presence. Yeah, you know, Jerry shows up and he's like, get out, I don't want to see you, I'm working. Yeah. But he's still capable of just like going and playing at a cafe and getting drawn into performing with his friends. Like, he's a crank, but he's not a bad crank. But the idea that he's just like sitting alone, conjuring up these fantasies where he's not only a world famous pianist, but also apparently a world famous kettle drummer and
conductor.
And his own biggest fans.
And his own biggest. The fact that he puts himself in the audience applauding for himself is just, I don't know. That's some Ouroboros stuff there. I'm not
sure.
It's
on brand for him.
Yeah.
It is on brand for him to be his own biggest fan.
Yeah. And like, if anything, like with his character specifically, like, if we're going off of the opening narration, you would think that he would be one of the other main characters of the film. Mm-hmm. He's not. Yeah. I mean, he's the main character of his own life, but he's not one of the main characters of the film in such a way.
First time, my husband and I were both absolutely convinced that the end of the movie would bring him and Milo together. Like, he is a penniless pianist in need of a constant patron, and she is a woman who apparently needs to buy relationships and feel like she's supporting the arts. Why wouldn't they end up together? Well, because Lerner doesn't care at all about either of them.
I mean, they have that. They do get that scene at the party at the end together, where he spills the beans. So maybe we can just like assume the groundwork is being laid there for to become his patron after this.
Great scene, by the way. It's mm-hmm. tight. It's well written, but it's also just surprising several times over mm-hmm. because she comes out and tells him the truth, like, immediately. There's no Three's Company, like, wacky hijinks with them running around and, like, he doesn't realize she knows and she didn't tell him on purpose, but now she knows he knows, blah, blah, blah. She just comes out like a grown-up and says, you've misunderstood something here, and I don't want you to be embarrassed. You should know this. And he's like, no, I am actually aware of this and I did it on purpose. It speaks so well to both of them. I want these two to end up together. I'm rooting for these crazy kids. But Genevieve, it sounded like you had another song that you also thought was a standard.
Yeah, well, I wanted to call out the Stairway to Paradise, Henri's like club number, just because I think it's beautifully sung in a way that most of the other numbers are, you know, I feel like the focus is a little more on the dancing, the overall tableau, the children. But, you know, I mean, obviously, it's a showy number, what with the glowing staircase and the showgirls and whatnot. But like, there's not really like the dancing isn't very flashy. It's more just about like him singing. And I think he sings beautifully. And it was just kind of nice to have like, oh, a really well-performed song instead of a number, you know?
I really like him as a screen presence. George, I'm going to butcher the name, but George Guiteret. I know him basically from this movie. I'm looking at his filmography.
This is like his only film, pretty much. Yeah.
A little bit of trivia here. And if you think this film is squirmy as it is, they wanted Maurice Chevalier for that role. He would have been 61 when this film came out.
But that would have been like more in line with the character who is supposed to be like older and is he's actually like the actor is actually like a couple years younger than Gene Kelly, right? As if I recall.
I've never had a ward, and I've been happily married for years. But if I did have a ward, I don't really see myself falling.
Again, a very different time where that kind of thing was more done. And, you know, people also married their cousins. Like, people growing up in proximity to people who are part of the bloodline, you know, not as weird and taboo as it feels today. But yes, it's somebody that you cared for and essentially raised when her parents died, becoming a romantic interest, it just feels sticky to me.
And also, like, I know it's the times, whatever, but like some, like a person who is not fully cooked yet, like 19 is not old enough, you know, like
she's got a job.
I think she was 17 when this was shot.
The actress was 17, but I think they say the character is 19.
Yeah, of course. And that's just one of the reasons she looks so unbaked. Like, the character's 19, the actress is 17, and the actress got pulled into this story because Gene Kelly saw her in Paris in doing ballet when she was 15 and somehow said,
"Don't like it.
Let's get her over here for like a big romantic movie with me somehow."
I know it's controversial to say, but I do not condone that.
No. I was going to say the film itself almost seems to acknowledge how like icky it might be, because even Henri has like lines inserted where he's, "Oh no, we only fell in love like once she was old enough." And it's like, oh, so you acknowledge that this might be weird.
I'm not sure what to make of Lisa in general. Maybe my favorite sequence in the entire film was her introduction, where Henri is talking about her, and it's just a series of contradictions, and, you know, not major ones. Like, she's cheerful and gay, and yet also she reads, if you can imagine such a thing. But, you know, the fantasy portrayals of, presumably this is how Jerry is trying to imagine her. But all of it is ballet, you know, of course, an arty.
Well, there's some jazz in there, too.
Fair. But yeah. I mean, even the jazz is just very ballet oriented. Like, I kind of love the fact that, like, oh, of course, somebody who reads all the time would be like a dour librarian type in all black who would also just do the splits constantly against walls while she reads.
Well, I'm like, this whole sequence for me, I'm like, women can't win. Like, if you're like, if you read, it means you're not fun. Like, if you're this, it means you're that. Like, you just can't be like, oh, she reads. Sounds good. She's well read. Like, it can't just be that. It means like some negative consequence.
Oh, she's cheerful? That must mean she's shallow and stupid.
Exactly. You can't win.
Is there commentary there? I'm always kind of like, you know, maybe the film is trying to point this out a little bit. I don't know.
I think it's just an excuse for like a showy sequence. I actually don't love that. I actually find the first like few scenes of this movie to be like a little try hard, I guess. the trading opening narration, and then kind of immediate, and then with this Lisa introduction, and like immediately on its heels, just I'm not gonna go quite so far as to call it a gimmick, but you know, it's like it's throwing a lot of stuff out there, you know. And I don't dislike the Lisa introduction in concept, but I feel like it just goes on like three beats too long, you know, kind of the same with the narration. It's like it just does it three times over again, you know. It's just kind of, it's like piling up flourishes right at the beginning, and the film does settle down until the 17 minute dream ballet at the end, which is the opposite of settling down. So I guess it comes in real hot and it goes out real hot, but it calms down in the middle.
That said, the opening does firmly establish why Leslie Caron was cast in this film. I mean, she's an amazing dancer. And like, I've never, you know, I know I've seen people dance on point. And certainly, you know, I know what it is. But when you actually watch her feet in those moments, like, how is this humanly possible to do these things? But at the same time, I don't get caught up in the technique of it, though, because I do. It's not just showy for showy's sake. But it's an amazing image just to see mm-hmm. someone prance around like that.
Yeah, similarly, I think it's an amazing image to see somebody in a room where literally everything is green. You know, the walls are green, but also the doors are green, the fireplace is green, the vases and the flowers are green, the paintings on the wall are green. Like, all of those scenes are set up, you know, color-coded in ways that are very showy, very try-hard. Maybe the whole sequence is too long because having put the effort into the set dressing, they wanted to get their money's worth. Oh, yeah. I agree that it goes on too long, but I don't know, for me, it's playful in a way not enough of the rest of the movie is. And it really kind of speaks to Jerry's faults more than anything else. Like, it's not really talking about how she's, you know, too many things or not enough things, or even really portraying her personality. It's just kind of portraying his prejudices. You know, he's the one asking all of the dumb questions about, oh, she's so she's bad then. And he's the one, like, presumably visualizing all of this stuff. But I don't know. I agree that it could be trimmed. I think maybe each segment could be trimmed rather than cutting one of the iterations. But I think it's visually fun.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
What do we make of the whole business with her? I feel like this movie just sets her up as such a sharp contrast with Milo, because, you know, Milo, as we say, our villain, is being forthright about, not exactly forthright about what she wants, but at least forthright about wanting to see Jerry and be part of his life and work with him. Whereas Lisa is forthright about the fact that she doesn't. She does not want to be part of his life. She does not want to be involved with him. He meets her by engineering a dance with her, by lying to her friends and physically hauling her away from them in such a way that's like weaponizing her politeness because she's afraid to make a scene. And then she keeps telling him, no, stop, don't. And he's like, well, whatever, women are so cute. I just, it's not cute. It's not funny. It's kind of vile.
Mm-hmm. No, and then he stalks her. He like gets her number and then goes to her place of work. And like within 2 seconds, she's like, oh, never mind. I do like you. I don't like it now. I don't know if I would have felt differently about it and being an audience at the time, but I definitely don't like it now.
I guess the mitigating factor is it is Gene Kelly, who is very charming. Just a charming fellow on screen. This character, perhaps not, you know, I think it pushes his charm to its limits, though.
Yes.
It is, as you say, pretty aggressive behavior. That said, there's that smile, right? The smile goes a long way.
I mean, speaking
I don't think it should, but it does, I think, at least in the context of the film.
Hit on by strangers, a charming smile is just no substitute for somebody who proves they can listen to you when you say no. It's a really important part of dating people.
Yeah.
But I'll say this, I would buy the whole, okay, she's just sold on his charms thing, if we'd gotten a musical number in there. Which both would have taken it all out of the realm of any kind of reality and into it's a musical fantasy, and would have really highlighted what he does best, because he's not playing the charm nearly enough in those scenes. He's just, you know, pushing her and saying, hey, your no doesn't matter to me. You're going to do what I say. But, you know, if he'd done a little tap dance, if he'd sung her a little love song, if he'd taken the whole thing back into, we're in a musical and everything goes kind of way, I think I probably would have bought the charm argument a little more here.
I mean, I think we have a version of that with the Love is Here to Stay dance along the river. Like, I think that is sort of the musical trope of our couple's love being cemented through their first dance. But you are right that there is like a beat missing where he like actually wins her over first. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe she could have witnessed him singing with the children, and that would have, you know, A, given that more of a point, and B, like, she could have borne witness to his charm when it wasn't like harassment directed at her.
Yeah, and he seems to have the impression that, like, he just needs to wear her down and then it will be fine. And it is, but, like, there is that background of, one of the reasons she's likely saying no to him as well is she's already promised to someone else. Like, mm-hmm. she's in a relationship. She's, you know, got a power dynamic there where that guy raised her, which is weird enough, and we've already talked about it. But, like, it's not that she's just like, oh, no, thanks. She's just in the back of her head. She must be like, oh, wait, I have someone else, right?
I would think so.
Okay, I would hope so.
Well, we've talked a lot about the dynamics here, but one thing that we've only very, very briefly glanced across is that party scene, which, boy, you talk about spectacle. Apart from the giant smoke fountain, a lot of that giant ballet number at the end kind of left me cold because it wasn't doing anything with the story. It wasn't doing anything with the characters. It's going on and on and on.
So this is where... I can't see eye to eye with you, Tosh. I just think that stuff is amazing. The filmmaking is so audacious. It just gives you one bit of spectacle, as you say, after another. The dancing is fantastic. I want to live in Technicolor. It's movies like this that make me want that. I don't know. I feel like, to me, this is the reason the movie exists. And it fully justifies that existence with that sequence.
I will give you this about that sequence. I enjoy both the set dressing, the decoration, and the camera work is pretty spectacular for the era. There's a lot of like just very mobile camera coming into places where you kind of have to question as somebody who's seen 50s musicals, like, how is he doing this? Is this all on a crane? Are there stitches here that I'm missing? It's really well choreographed in terms of camera movement. But I don't know, if I wanted to see a ballet, I would go to a ballet. The point I was making was just the party sequence for me has all of the things that people praise about that ballet number. I guess not as much of the dancing, but...
Or the Technicolor.
Oh, that's fair, because everybody's in black and white.
Yeah.
Well, it is Technicolor, but...
I know. You know what I mean.
The elaborate, just fantastic costumes, the giant energy of the place, the ridiculously like huge set and all of the movement around it.
The guy who keeps throwing himself off the balcony.
It's a lady. Yeah. She keeps throwing herself off the balcony and being caught by various people. And I cringed every time. Oh, my God. It seems so unsafe.
Yeah, every time. I think the older I get, the more I'm just like, no, that is not fun. That is not something you do at parties.
Don't get me wrong. It's a party I would hate to be at. It seems very loud. Nobody can hear anybody else. And they're just like, it's a giant COVID petri dish. They're just packed up shoulder to shoulder, stomach to back, all the way. But in terms of watching it, I don't know. I find that whole sequence so dynamic, and kind of the excitement of people finding each other within it and then trying to make space for each other and space for their own emotions within it, I think is just really compelling storytelling.
I remember when I was a child thinking that when my parents went to parties, it was like that, and then being sorely disappointed when my mom told me all they did was talk. And I was like, what are you talking about?
Go to those parties that nobody's wearing like a hat that was a giant tea kettle or like a huge, just, you know, 10-foot spiral that they weren't putting on their Harlequin costumes before they left.
Yeah, and this party has everything. It's just kind of like, I don't know, it's like Santa's bag. Like, if you reach in, you can find a quiet corner to have champagne and tell people I crap about patrons, and they can tell you they are a patron. Like, anything you need this party to be, it's going to be. Is there a balcony? Great. Can you overhear a conversation on? Even better.
It's a really great space. Here's my question about that space. Are they at the Moulin Rouge? Because at the point where he's up on the balcony in the background, like, clearly as part of the building, you can see the windmill. Like, you can see the big fans of the windmill, like, up very close. It certainly feels wild and strange and specific and thematic enough to be a Moulin Rouge party. But, you know, it's never mentioned.
I never even thought about that. That's cool.
I didn't either, but a quick Google indicates that you may be correct, Tasha, at least according to IMDb trivia, which is never wrong. So, the sight of a windmill arm before the final ballet indicates the party was held at or near the famed Paris night spot Moulin Rouge. So, you are not alone in noticing that generally, although in this call you are.
Well, I'm also not the one who noticed it generally. I got to credit my husband with that one.
Would you also like to know how many people on IMDb found that interesting? It was 3 out of 5.
Oh, I was going to say, is it more or less than people on this podcast?
Is it more or less than the number of years Leslie Caron was?
Well, to return once again at the end, as is appropriate to the Dream Ballet, Keith and Tasha, you seem to be like, you have different opinions on it. And I think as is so often the case, I fall kind of in the middle, because I agree with Tasha that like, I wish that there was a little more of the, what happens in the movie represented in that ballet. And it was more of sort of a culmination. And as it is, it feels just kind of like separate, you know, it does kind of exist on its own. You know, it's more of an homage to Paris, which is cool, great. But also the film doesn't feel particularly enamored or interested in Paris up until this point. I mean, obviously it's set there, but it's also a backlot Paris, and you know, it's the love story is the main concern. So I do love the spectacle. I love watching it. I get what you mean, Keith, about wanting to be in it. But I think in terms of how it works within the whole of the movie, there is just a feeling of separateness to it that contributes to making that final ending beat where Lisa returns feel even more just kind of tacked on, because it feels like, oh, the movie already ended. We already did like this little epilogue that has nothing to do with the rest of the movie. Oh, I guess we are back in the movie now.
I think for me, one of the issues with that sequence is that the length of it is driven by the length of the piece of music, An American in Paris.
Oh, also, and how much Gene Kelly wanted to show off. Like, it was very much like his baby, as I understand it.
Everything that I read about it made it sound like it was much more Fried's idea originally, specifically to take that piece of music and use it as the title and the end centerpiece. Mm. Although I could certainly see Kelly having a ton to do with exactly how it ends up being staged.
Yeah, and maybe he's more in the execution than the overall conception, but I know he has a reputation, or had a reputation, for being very exacting in about that kind of thing. So, but anyway, you were saying.
Regardless, it kind of comes back to my overall complaint often with jukebox musicals, is there's a feeling that everything is just kind of like clumsily bumping up against each other in such a way as to get us to this piece of music. And then when we do, it's not how much story do we have to tell with this dance number? How much emotion do we have to bring across? Or what do we need to express about what this man wants and feels? It's about, well, the piece of music is 17 minutes long and we decided we wanted to use it. And it feels so overextended to me. I was very, very much emotionally out of it by the end, even on first viewing.
Too much and not enough.
It felt longer to me before. I really, you know, to me, it's like, oh, it's over? I don't know. I was really into the ballet this time.
As always, Keith, I kind of wish that I had your experience of movies rather than my experience of movies sometimes. Yeah. I don't know, Deirdre, take us out of this. What's your big takeaway on the ballet scene? Too long, not long enough, whole movie should have been a ballet?
Oh, God. It's some of all of those. My whole thing is, like, so I really do like dance movies. I really do like musicals. And every time I watch this, like, I guess it depends on what mood I'm on. Sometimes it feels a little long. Sometimes it feels, you know, maybe I want some more. But I will say, in terms of these long sections of just pure performance inserted at the end of musicals, this one at least is a little bit more cohesive in terms of the plot and everything else that's happening. Like, I don't know, because I'm such a Singing in the Rain fan too. Like, I do look at that, and that one's just out of nowhere. Like, Gene Kelly's just like, I want to do this big Technicolor number, and it has next to nothing to do with the plot. It doesn't even have the main actress being in it anywhere. So for this one, I'm like, oh, we're actually continuing the story. Good for you. Like, yeah, I do like it. And also it does remind me of the Red Shoes every time. And I love the Red Shoes. So I'm just kind of like, the fact that this is making me like intellectually engage with films other than this one, and I'm like living a fantasy and then reflecting back on this, like, makes me wonder if I do like it as much as I say, or if I just think it makes sense. But yeah, I don't have a huge issue with it, but I also, if it weren't here, I wouldn't feel wanting.
Well, there's certainly worse things in art than reminding you of some of your all-time favorite art and making you appreciate that art more.
One could even say that's the conceit of this podcast.
I'm certainly not going to end on a more appropriate note than that. So I'm going to call it there. Would love to hear your thoughts on this discussion and on anything else in the world of film. Let us know how you feel about jukebox musicals. Has there ever been a great jukebox musical? Not in terms of the music, but in terms of the story. This is something we were talking about a little bit before the podcast. Has there ever been a jukebox musical where the story stands up as well as the music does?
Have you ever heard of Singing in the Rain?
I have never heard of Singing in the Rain.
That would be one.
I've heard of Babylon, which is a movie remarkably similar to Singing in the Rain.
Well, that's the movie that Singing in the Rain ripped off, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, probably the movie that Singing in the Rain was based on. Fair enough, Keith. Like, way to undercut all the people about to call us and write to us. And
just taking that one off the table. There's plenty more.
Yeah, let us know. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. And we'll be back in a moment with some feedback. It's time for feedback, but before we get into it, we should pause to remind everyone to listen to Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's mothership podcast, hosted by Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. As we record this, they've recently released an episode on M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin for fans of new films and an appreciation of the enduring power of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho for classics fans. That's two very different thrillers to explore this month. As for our podcast, we've got a few call-ins here discussing our pairing of Children of Men and The Last of Us. Remember how we called out longtime film critic and friend of the show, Mike D'Angelo, for his 80 Club commentary on Children of Men? He has a rebuttal for us. Let's listen.
Hey, y'all. Mike D'Angelo here. You probably guessed that I might call in. I am a faithful listener, as somebody mentioned, and always enjoy the show. And when I saw that you were doing Children of Men, I thought, controversial opinion on that film's lengthy, unbroken takes might come up as a topic of discussion, which indeed it did. I am totally at peace with having a lonely opinion on that. I don't want to have a big debate, but there were a couple of things that got a bit lost in translation. So I just want to clear them up. I'll try to be real quick about it. One is there was a lot of discussion about blinking. If you go back and read the piece that I wrote for the AV Club a million years ago, I guess listeners can just Google Scenic Routes and Children of Men. It'll come right up. I barely mentioned blinking at all. That was just thrown in as the most obvious example of how human vision is not continuous. That was actually, I was making the same point that Scott made in the episode about Children of Men, which is that it's a camera. and there's, the camera is not the same as the human eye, and so there's no reason for it to be blinking. That's absolutely correct. I did not mean to suggest that the film is those shots are taking a human point of view, or that they should. I was basically arguing against the argument that other people have made when they say that cuts are somehow alien to the way that we see the world, and it is more representative to not cut and show things continuously. My argument was that that's not true, because not so much because of blinking, mostly because of I talked much more in detail about what are called saccades, which is the way the human eyeball jumps from focal point to focal point in ways that I argued are analogous to cuts. But very little to do with blinking. That was not a big deal. And then the second thing, real quick, is that Tasha made very eloquently, I thought, the best case, in my opinion, in favor of shots like that, which is basically that they're more immersive, they're more intense. And the way she put it was they don't give you an opportunity to breathe. They don't provide any respite. And basically, my argument has always been good continuity editing accomplishes the same thing. The cut itself does not provide a pause or a breath or a respite. It depends on what the cut is doing. So if you cut somewhere else, then sure. But if you just cut from one moment, one angle of a moment to a different angle of that same moment, and it's very clear that no time has passed and we're in the same place, that's not providing a breath. It's, to me, it's no less immersive or intense just because there was a cut.
Well, I'm glad Mike called in to clarify that, because there are definitely details in that that I had forgotten. And I honestly really should have gone back and reread that column before we recorded, because I was pretty sure that I was going to try to bring it up at some point. But we have talked through our feelings on Long Takes kind of at length, and we're going to get into it even more in a second with a second letter and a second call-in. But before we do, let's just get a baseline here, Deirdre, for your thoughts. Mike's saying that his issue with them is that they just don't represent, you know, how humans work. And we kind of went back and forth in our own conversation about, are they a good thing or not? Is it immersive or distracting to see a long take? Does it take you out of a movie to think too much about how was this done and what were the technical aspects of it? What's your take? What's your feeling on really long takes in cinema or TV, really?
They definitely do take me out of it a little bit, like in Touch of Evil, where you're like, ooh, how'd they do this? They're moving an entire town around. But the film is an art form. It is entirely constructed. And I don't necessarily need to be immersed in it to the level of forgetting that that's the case. I think when it comes down to, like, I don't know, I always think about like edits and whatnot. That's part of the language of cinema. All of us are fluent, so it's very hard to see the line between that. But like when you read a book, people don't talk in sentences. Like any of us who've ever had to transcribe an interview knows that. Like people don't talk in sentences. They go all over the place. So I don't really have an issue necessarily with different art forms taking on their own language of communication and then sticking to that. So I guess my point is that like I love that a long take does call attention to it. And it does make me wonder, like, how many extras did you have? But it is a movie, so I don't really have... I don't think Children of Men is real. Any of the stuff in RRR with, like, all of those extras, I don't for a second think that is real. And acknowledging...
Whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah, but, like, acknowledging
famous
that
documentary,
real...
Children of Men?
Yeah.
For RRR.
I know, sorry. I'm breaking truth bombs here.
The animals are real, though, right? The animals...
Oh, just yeah.
Tell me the animals are real.
Tigers were super excited to do that. Yeah. But no, like, it isn't real. Like, calling attention to that and then constructing the art form around it, isn't that kind of the point of movies? Like, that's kind of movie magic in itself. I have no issue with that.
It's a point of movies. I think that it's... I'm right there with you. I think that it's an artistic choice, and it's just as valid an artistic choice as Paul Greengrass's United 93 trying to do a shaky cam, you are there immersive thing. Or, you know, Milos Forman or Stanley Kubrick doing these like cold, formal, pinned down, everything plotted and planned kind of things. Like these are very, very different ways of doing cinema, but, you know, they're meant to, the filmmaking's meant to be part of the story. And I don't know, I'm with you. I think long takes are as valid a way of filmmaking as any, regardless of whether they take you out of the film. But we have another letter here from somebody else who called in with a lot of thoughts about our Children of Men episode and some thoughts about long form takes in general and our thoughts on them in specific. Let's listen to this one from Luke in Rhode Island.
Hi, this is Luke from Rhode Island. And I was really struck by something that came up in your discussion of Children of Men, which was the idea that a long take could actually be less immersive than a conventional edited style of filmmaking, because you become aware of just how hard it must have been to pull off this continuous long take. And I just think that's a really interesting irony, which points to how incredibly effective the established conventions of cinematography and editing in the continuity style are at creating the illusion of continuous time, space, and story. And it actually made me grateful that our human faculties of perception and our story-seeking brains are so primed to put together disparate elements into something that makes sense, that as the conventions of continuity storytelling were invented by filmmakers, it became really possible and really effective with, I don't know, 10 or 20 different rules of editing and, you know, angles, to be able to create this illusion that's so immersive that it's actually more immersive than true continuity in filmmaking. So I just think that's really interesting. And it leads me to a kind of discussion challenge for you, which is, what's your favorite long take in cinema? Either because it doesn't take you out of the story or for some other reason. And I guess a second part to that is, why do you think there's such a fetish for the long take in cinema fandom?
So there's more to this, Colin. It was a fairly long one. We've cut it down a little bit. But in the part that we're giving you here, there are kind of two discussion topics. Why are people so taken with long takes in cinema? And what are our favorites? As far as why people are so into them, I think we covered that a fair bit on the last set of podcasts, just in terms of, you know, it's virtuoso work. It makes you excited about the filmmaking. It involves you in it or draws you into it or takes you out of it and excites you. Either way, I think there are a bunch of reasons there. But I do want to get into the what are your favorites? Like, what comes to mind when somebody asks you for your favorite long take in cinema?
Well, I'll start with, I wouldn't go so far as to call this my favorite long take, but it is certainly the first one that came to mind in the context of this conversation. And that's the opening of Robert Altman's The Player, which I saw for the first time actually in college in a class, not a film class, an English class. I believe it was like a modernism seminar. I can't remember exactly, but, you know, we watched it as a class, as a specifically to talk about the opening and sort of just the meta and self-referential elements of it. So, you know, we're having these discussions about long takes and whether they draw us into a film or take us out of it. So I immediately thought of like the first long take I was like presented with to study. It's a great sequence for like a lot of reasons. It's not necessarily like the showiest in terms of like stuff going on, but it's such a good delivery device for that Altman overlapping dialogue, because like you're actually moving in and out of the space as that dialogue is like weaving in and out of each other. You get this, it establishes the world of this backlot. It's a very impressive establishing shot. There's not necessarily like big events happening in it the way there are, say, in the Children of Men long takes. And it's also a shot that's like very much designed to signal like, you are watching a movie. Like it begins with a shot of a painting of a film set, and then there's like a clapper, a director shouting action, and it turns into the shot. And it's very much like yelling, this is a construct, you know, you are watching a movie. There's references in there to Touch of Evil and Absolute, like it actually references other movies with long takes in it. And then there's just like a lot of funny stuff worked into like him being pitched a sequel to The Graduate. So it's a long take about filmmaking. And so the idea that you are thinking about how it works is built into how it works. So I thought it was an appropriate one for this particular thought exercise.
That's a really good one. It's one of the ones I thought of. And the first ones I thought of are the really obvious ones. One, you know, Goodfellas, beginning of Touch of Evil, and the beginning of Boogie Nights, which is amazing. So I think too quickly from opposite ends of what they're doing. There's the Sokurov film Russian Ark, which is amazing, which is one, really, it is, the whole film is one take, and no joke, it is, there's no faking it, it's one edit, it's an unedited
city. It's not 1917-ing it.
right, exactly, through the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg and 300 years of Russian history as hosted by a ghost, you know, it's a ghost story too. But also, what I love is where there's no move, and that thing moves all through everywhere and looks around, and, you know, but another one I love is the end of Big Night, which is just, you know, it just holds on that moment. And any editing there, I think, would just break the spell of that there. So sometimes it's about moving the camera. Sometimes it's just about keeping the camera in one place. And just in general, I'm a fan of long shots. Good long shots are good. That's my opinion. Tasha, how about you?
Well, I think I may have touched on this one in the discussion last time, but immediately the first thing that came to my mind was the sequence from Atonement, where James McAvoy is walking along the beach at Dunkirk. The British soldiers are piled up and waiting for transport. They've been pushed to the sea. And he spends 5 minutes walking through this chaos of like broken down machinery and guns still being like a giant gun still being fired upwards. And there's a bandstand where people are standing and singing and a kind of a carnival in the distance with like a working Ferris wheel still going. And it's chaos, you know, it's the chaos of thousands of men who have nowhere to go and nothing to do and are either occupying themselves. There's just one sequence where he walks by somebody who's doing a workout regimen on a pommel horse, or they're at work with the various things that they're meant to be doing as part of the army, or they're just standing around, or they're trying to keep their spirits up. You know, there's smoke and damage everywhere. It's just a lot. And it's a capturing of a scene and all of these different kind of complications of a scene that's going on, where many, many different people are making many different choices. It's not an action sequence. Like, nothing comes of it in the way that the Children of Men action sequences all lead to. Usually people dying and things changing in dramatic ways. Like, nothing huge is decided or changes during the scene. He's just finding his way through chaos. And that, I think, for me, is just a particularly poignant sequence, because it's just about exploring an environment that is continuous in the way that reality is. You know, if you're walking down the beach and seeing many different things, there are no cuts, there are no story elements. You just, everything around you is there and is all just kind of part of the same world. Even if, you know, at one place you're watching people scream and try to like haul somebody drowning out of the surf, and 50 feet up the beach is, you know, somebody flexing for an audience of people shooting him for Instagram. You know, just very different experiences within the same space. I think that's a really cool use of the single take. There's also 2015's Victoria, the 2-hour, 20-minute single shot movie, which Luke actually did call out in the rest of this call and talked about how cool that movie is, how immersive it is, how surprising it is technologically. And we had to cut it down for length, but I was really, really glad he said he came to it because of this podcast. I think it was one of our Your Next Picture Show recommendations ages ago. But I was just so happy for the shout out. I'm so happy whenever anybody listens to one of my obscure recommendations and digs it. And I will always stand up for Sebastian Shipper's Victoria and just the completely amazing technological achievement that it is, and the weird immersive experience that it is. Deirdre, what about you?
So without hesitation, I think my favorite giant long take is from Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend, where it's just like you're following this, starts out kind of a traffic jam and it doesn't even crescendo. It just keeps getting weirder and then goes back to normality. And there's dead people and there's a plane crash and things are on fire and there's fire trucks. And for a couple times, the couple in a car that we're tracking along with, they kind of get behind, they might get in for ahead. It's just, it's not even utter chaos. It's very confined chaos. It's just, you don't quite know what's going to happen next. And Godard is like, or was notorious for just taking the language of cinema and exploiting it and being like, I'm going to make it so you don't know where to look. Like, I'm going to make it so you're hyper-focused on something and it's not what you should be looking at. Like, he's going to either have a take that's 10 minute long, or he's going to have jump cuts that make it seem like everything's on fast forward when it's actually in real time. And I really appreciate that about him. But just watching this, it's like, how did he do this? How did he do this? This weird little grumpy French man in the 60s who couldn't have had that big of a budget. It just has utter control over this environment and mayhem and death and everything. And he's just kind of taking us through it. And your eye gets to decide where to look. And each time I watch it, I see something new, and I've seen it dozens of times. Like, it's just, it's incredible for me. And it's just such an immersive experience. And it's a hard film to recommend to anyone, but it's just, for me, I'm just like, I'm going to be watching it. You can join me if you'd like.
Yeah, that's great. And that's one where I think it does something that really great long shots do, is like, you know, you just kind of get caught up in it. It's like, am I really seeing what I think I'm seeing? How long has this been going on? I really do like a long take where it's like a minute or so in before you realize there hasn't been a cut, and it has that kind of desired effect of really just kind of putting you under the spell of what that filmmaker is doing. And that's certainly an example of that.
Well, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations, and also their prompts and questions. If you feel so inclined, we could feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at a much more modern style of dance and a much more modern style of letting a woman pay for dinner in Magic Mike's Last Dance. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, I really do actually want to hear Adam's story about his command performance for Hitler. That sounded really interesting.